it's important for young lawyers to understand the difference between making money, servicing a client, and doing what's right. What advice would you give in that regard?
Lawyer can't have his or her ethics determined by the client, even if it means losing the client. If a lawyer purports to be his client's lackey and is going to go around and engage in activities that he knows he ought not, he sooner or later is going to be in real trouble.
All rise.
All rise.
The Honorable Chief Justice and
Associate Justices of the Supreme Court.
The State of North Carolina.
Yes, oh yes, oh yes. The Supreme Court of North
All
Carolina.
All of our citizens across the state depend upon us to uphold and protect both the spirit and the letter of the law, and to always apply the law fairly and impartially to every litigant who comes before this court.
God save the state and this honorable court.
Hello and welcome to All Things Judicial, a podcast of the North Carolina Judicial Branch. I'm Chris Mears with the Judicial Branch Communications Office. In today's episode, we feature an excerpt of a 2001 interview with Francis Parker, who was a leader of the Charlotte legal community, founding partner of the Parker Poe Law Firm, and Associate Justice of the Supreme Court of North Carolina. In addition, Parker served in World War II and Korea and practiced law for over 50 years. In this interview, Parker shares about his early years, his legal career in Charlotte, and outlines what professionalism means for lawyers in North Carolina's legal community. This interview was conducted by Chief Justice's Commission on Professionalism's former executive director, Mel Wright, for the Commission's historical video series. Wright speaks first in the interview.
Mr. Parker, if you will, tell us a little bit about your early background in education, where you grew up, and a little bit about your family.
Well, I was born on August 21st, 1923, in the St. Peter's Hospital in Charlotte. My family lived there and have lived in Charlotte all my life, except when I was away at school and in the service. Attended the Charlotte City Schools, and when I got to the high school, I was sent away to Woodbury Forest up in Virginia, and then entered the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and went through the university's law school.
As I understand it, your father was a lawyer and was also a judge. From what I understand, he was a judge on the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. He was also one of the judges in the Nuremberg trials. And what influence, if any, did your dad have on you in your early career as a lawyer? And did he have any effect on your decision to become a lawyer?
Well, my father, of course, is my hero. And he was appointed to the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit in 1925 and remained on that court for the rest of his life, with his death in 1958. I was 2 years old when he went on the bench, so I never remember him as a lawyer. But I guess from my earliest recollections, I was exposed to lawyers and judges. I was the youngest child in my father's household. Although my father never suggested that he thought I ought to be a lawyer, he always told me I ought to do whatever it was I thought I was going to be happy doing. And as long as I was prepared to work hard and give it my best shot, I would say that the exposure, he being my father, and the close association that we have, that I developed pretty early on the belief that lawyers were a member of ancient, honorable, and noble profession. Although as a young fella, I really didn't picture myself much as a lawyer. I had some ambition of going to the Naval Academy and being a career naval officer. I don't know what my father thought about that, except he said if when the time came, if I really wanted to go, he'd see if he should help me get in.
Now, you did have some association with the Navy, as I understand it, following your time in Chapel Hill. But when you were in Chapel Hill, I believe you were in the Naval ROTC program, were you not?
Yes.
Tell us about those days in Chapel Hill and the ROTC program.
Well, I entered Chapel Hill in the fall of 1941, and shortly thereafter, the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. World War II became a reality. I suppose on the campus of Chapel Hill at that time, most of the guys were pretty anxious to get out and win the war, and I guess most of the girls who were there thought that was not a bad idea. I volunteered in the Naval Reserve and was accepted in the Naval ROTC there at Chapel Hill. During the upheavals of those times, it was somewhat difficult to pursue the intellectual avenues that were available to you, because I guess most of us thought we ought to be out to win the war. But I did manage to major in political science with a pretty heavy dose of history and naval science. I was commissioned an ensign in the Naval Reserve in January 1945, and ultimately ended up on a destroyer out at Okinawa at about the time they dropped the bomb. I guess it was on the way home in the latter part of 45 and 46 that appreciated that I was not going to the Naval Academy and was not going to make Navy a career. Decided what I guess I had always known, that I was going to pursue the law. And I remember writing my father a letter, he being in Nuremberg at the time, and told him that there were lots of law schools to go to, but I was glad to get home, and I thought I'd go to Chapel Hill.
Was it difficult to get in Chapel Hill Law School at that time?
No, I got returned to Charlotte, I guess, July of 46, and drove up Chapel Hill and saw Dean Wellick, and it was pretty easy. I think he had to establish the fact that you had a college degree from somewhere, and maybe more important, had a place to live.
When you went to law school at Chapel Hill in 1946, was there emphasis at that time on ethics and professionalism? Do you remember that being a part of the curriculum?
I don't recall ever having taken any course on ethics or professionalism. The faculty at Chapel Hill at that time was pretty well situated, and the faculty was small, and they had all been there for a good many years. There was Dean Robert Wellick and Maurice Van Hecke, who had been a former dean, and of course Albert Coates and Fred McCall, all of whom were gentlemen and teachers of the first class. And over the years, occasionally, they would be mentioning of what was expected of lawyers, but I don't recall any particular curriculum about it.
So at that time, the emphasis that you may have garnered on ethics and professionalism came from your professors and how they taught you should act as lawyers.
That's right. They occasionally would refer to sharp practices, which you weren't supposed to do. And I guess the law school basically was an extension of the university's honor system, and that you were gentlemen and ladies. I think there were three or four ladies in our class. And you didn't lie, cheat, or steal, and you didn't associate with those that did.
What year, if you recall, did you finish in Chapel Hill Law School?
49.
And when you finished in 49, how did you decide where you were going to go to practice?
As I say, I lived in Charlotte all my life, and that's where my friends were, my family. I guess it was the summer after my first year in law school, which was summer of 47. I came home from Chapel Hill and decided we'd maybe get gainfully employed down at one of the banks. So that was in the days when you could stroll into the office of the president of the First Union. Oh, it wasn't First Union, it was Union National. And I did, and the president was very cordial to me, but he said they had a certain amount of summer internships, and I was a little late since they had already hired all the people from Davidson they were going to hire, and they didn't need any more. And shortly thereafter, I saw Joe Greer, who was a friend of family's. He was a contemporary of my older brother, John, and he at that time was practicing in the firm of Tall, Clarkson, and Greer. And he asked me what I was doing. I said, well, I just went down to see fell it out at First Union, and they needed help, so I'm not doing anything at the moment except playing a little tennis, maybe. He says, why don't you come on down to the office sometime, and I'll show you around. So I did, and then the truth about it has been there ever since.
Tell us about the firm that you started with in 1949, where it was situated, what the building was called, and what practice in law was like in Charlotte in 1949 in the early 50s.
The firm was known as Tolliver Clarkson and Greer, and they had an office in the old Charlotte Law Building, which was right there on the courthouse square, so to speak, right next to the courthouse. Lawyers in Charlotte, when I was sworn in, there were me and three others. Most of the lawyers maintained their offices in the Charlotte Law Building, which was an eight-story building, although there were some experts in taxation and one thing or another who were known as uptown lawyers. As a young lawyer or any lawyer that was in the law building, you'd see about 75% of the bar every day, either going back and forth to the courthouse or riding on the elevator or in the soda shop, where a lot of tall tales were told. The firm consisted of three partners, and I was the associate, and they had engaged in a general civil practice with some forays into the criminal field, but not very seriously. And being the youngest fellow there, I got to do an awful lot of things that the other people didn't want to do, which was good training. And you'd be what they now referred to as a Renaissance lawyer, which is some fellow who is now, I suppose, fool enough to try to do everything.
When you first started, and I know you said you were in a general practice firm at that time, did you have any mentors, anybody that you considered your mentor or mentors that you looked up to and respected?
Well, I would say any of those three partners. Of course, still feel pretty close to Joe Greer, although we don't practice law together anymore. And Mr. Tolliver and Judge Clarkson, Mr. Tolliver was just a perfect ethical gentleman, as indeed was Judge Clarkson. And I remember one particular instance about Mr. Tolliver. He used to think, in many instances, that a lawyer was his client's conscience. And there was an event that happened. I hadn't been practicing very long, and one of the firm's established clients had gotten in some terrible scrape when they were trying to make a lot of money fast. And they came into the office one day to see Mr. Tolliver, and he sent me to do a lot of legwork and get him up a little report and memorandum, which I did. I remember one day Mr. Tolliver came into my office and said, Mr. So-and-so and his associates are coming in, and I want you to sit in there with me. So that conference went along, and finally, Mr. Tolliver says, well, your problem is such and such, and I believe we can help you. We'll do the best we can. Then he said, tell me how it is you got into this matter to start with. And I'll never forget the sheepish look on this client's face. He says, Carol, we didn't come to you because we knew you wouldn't let us do it, and we figured we could get away with it. And, you know, I sort of figured maybe that's about the best compliment a fellow can pay a lawyer.
And do you think it's important for young lawyers today who don't start with a large firm like yours? There are young lawyers who start out on their own, or in a two-man firm with two law students together. Is it important for them to have a mentor?
I think so. And I think the bar in Charlotte has attempted to foster that, although I don't know how successful it's been. I remember when I started, there were some of the older lawyers would associate the young lawyers in a particular case to serve two purposes. I guess maybe the first thing was that they had an opportunity to earn a fee, as well as the older lawyer had an opportunity to have some connection with the younger lawyer and vice versa. I'm not sure anybody does that anymore, but maybe they do.
We'll be right back.
Hey, Susan, great to see you. Shopping for coffee?
Hey, Sharon. Yeah, work's been really draining, and I need extra caffeine just to get motivated to finish the day.
Well, you should really consider applying to work with me in the judicial branch. I know we're hiring for positions down at the courthouse.
Really? Huh. I never really thought about a career with the courts.
Well, you should. I love my job. I work 8 to 5 Monday through Friday, and I have generous paid vacation and sick leave, plus 12 paid holidays a year.
No way. Do you have medical coverage too?
I sure do. I have medical coverage, a retirement plan, and flexible benefits that include vision and dental, among other benefits. and they trained me on what I needed to do.
Wow, that really does sound like a great job. Where can I learn more?
You can go to nccourts.gov/careers and view any current vacancies.
Great, I'm going to check it out tonight.
Don't wait any longer to start a rewarding career with the judicial branch. We have positions available in all 100 North Carolina counties. Do your career justice and apply today. Visit nccourts.gov/careers to learn more.
We now return to a 2001 interview with Charlotte attorney Francis Parker. In this segment, Parker reflects on his time in the Korean War and focuses on the challenges of practicing law in a large metropolitan area.
It's important for young lawyers to understand the difference between making money, servicing a client, and doing what's right. What advice would you give in that regard if a developer comes in who's pushy and is insisting on things being done quickly and maybe not necessarily in accordance with the codes and the rules? What advice would you give in that regard?
Well, that's pretty tough. A lawyer basically has got to understand what's right. A lawyer can't have his or her ethics determined by the client, even if it means losing the client. But most people are reasonable business people, and they ought to, and some good many do, understand the situation. If a lawyer purports to be his client's lackey and is going to go around and engage in activities that he knows he ought not, he sooner or later is going to be in real trouble.
Now, after practicing for a short period of time in Charlotte, the Korean conflict occurred. Did you have to go back in, or did you volunteer to go back in? Tell us about that period and how that affected you.
I didn't volunteer. It used to be that once you were commissioned in the Naval Reserve, you never really got out. When World War II was over, all the commissioned people were separated to inactive duty and went into what they call the Volunteer Reserve. They also had the Organized Reserve. And the Organized Reserve, you got paid some stipend for engaging in once a week maybe in some training exercise and going off a week or so during the summer to some training cruise. I was in what was called the Volunteer Reserve, be it voluntary or involuntary. But when the Korean business came along in 1950, the Navy called up a lot of its volunteer people and the volunteer reserves, and I went back to another destroyer for about 18 months. My firm gave me a leave of absence. They fortunately were still there when I came back. They'd be glad to see me.
After practicing and starting your family in Charlotte, that time away, leaving again to go back in the service, did that in any way affect your opinion about the profession, about professionalism, the discipline that you needed in your life? Did that affect you at all?
Well, yeah, I suppose it would. I didn't do anything in the Navy that was in any wise comparable to practicing law, although that's not true either. I was a legal officer on this destroyer, which consisted of being the, among other things, trial counsel on a summary court martial, so I handled there on the ship before it got to be a serious matter. They got sent to a general court martial on the beach. But my Navy experience, I learned about duty and responsibility, and I mean duty and responsibility to superiors as well as to subordinates. And I guess thing that I came closest home to me was it's right hard to supervise somebody if you don't really know what it is they're supposed to be doing.
And that applies whether you're dealing with sailors or lawyers, I'm sure.
Absolutely.
Yes. Is there a suggestion that you could make to lawyers today in large metropolitan areas to maybe better help the collegiality and civility in a particular case when you start a case with a lawyer you don't know or haven't had an occasion to meet before?
It obviously is something that you have to make a definite concentrated effort to do. And it doesn't seem like it was awful long ago, but I guess it was 20 years ago. The bar attempted to have a luncheon every week, every Thursday maybe, at the Flux. And it was very enthusiastic, and it went on for several months. And I remember, but it began to dwindle away. And I remember Joe Greer came in one afternoon and said, well, the bar's been disgraced. I says, well, what are you talking about? He said, I went over to the courthouse and got three Superior Court judges and took them out to the bar's lunch, and there wasn't a solitary soul there. I says, well, that is pretty disgraceful. I'm glad he didn't ask me where I was.
What advice would you give to high school students or college students who are thinking about making law a career?
Well, I think that they ought to understand that the practice of law is a profession, and that a profession is different from other activities. Although it's sort of gotten to be a business here late, the financial aspects of it.
Tell us about your feelings about pro bono service and community service by lawyers.
Well, I think that lawyers either ought to engage in a certain amount of pro bono work, or if they're not going to do the work themselves, they ought to support other lawyers and groups that do. There are a good many people that need a lot of legal help. Well, the various legal aid societies, and I think, do a pretty good job of representing people who are indigent, and the individuals who are wealthy can afford to hire the best lawyers and pay exorbitant fees. In between, there's a great group of people who have got great misgivings about lawyers, about it's going to cost them an arm and a leg, and don't seek legal services. And then it seems to me that it's that group that somehow needs to get targeted by the bar.
We've also seen a decline in lawyers in our legislature, lawyers in public service. Was there greater emphasis when you first started for lawyers to participate in community and statewide service?
Well, I think so. Of course, that was in the days when that might have been the lawyers' best form of advertisement. They didn't have business development committees in those days, and a lawyer got known by starting around out in his community and his church and city clubs and civic organizations. Always remember the famous story attributed to Sam Irvin, the senator, who had a lot of funny stories, but he always would cite from time to time the young lawyer's prayer was, "O Lord, stir up strife amongst our people, lest our servant perish."
Thank you for that. He was quite a character. What would you say that the lawyers of North Carolina could and should do to improve upon the elements of principles of professionalism, such as civility and competence, honesty and integrity, respect for the law, pro bono service, community service, mentoring? What emphasis would you put on professionalism as far as our present bar is concerned?
I used to think lawyers were several cuts above, and probably we still are, but we have suffered a great deal from the cultural revolution of the 1960s, I guess. And how you go about so-called putting the genie back in the bottle, I don't know.
Do you think judges can help in the area of professionalism?
Yes, judges ought to be the leaders of the bar, and hopefully they were all good professionals before they got to be judges. And I think that judges do, by and large, control their courtrooms. And if lawyers are taking advantage of the system or not showing the proper respect for the court, or indeed other counsel, or witnesses and clients, I think that's the judge's responsibility. I remember a funny story. Doesn't exactly involve lawyers, but does involve judge. There was a judge was trying a case involving title to land, which was pretty obviously a trumped-up sort of case, and he tried it, and then instructed the jury and gave them a virtual peremptory instruction for the defendant. The jury went out and came back in about 10 minutes with judgment for the plaintiff. The judge supposedly very courteously thanked them for their services, this being back in the days when the jury were all male. And he says, "Gentlemen, I want you to know and understand that it takes 13 men to steal a piece of land in this state, and I'm not going to be one of them."
Well, and I think our judges are going to become more and more involved in professionalism than
I think so.
When you remember the many people you considered outstanding lawyers during your career, what was it about them that set them apart and made them outstanding in your mind?
Well, I think basically their impeccable moral character. I thought that they were courageous. They didn't object to taking unpopular adversarial positions. When they thought the cause was right, they were gentlemen, they were courteous, and they worked hard. They expected a lot of people, expected a lot of themselves.
We've become a society intent on winning. Do you have any advice to young lawyers on the importance of justice and doing a job correctly rather than winning at all cost?
Well, I suppose the best answer to that, which is maybe the motto of the Office of the United States Solicitor General, and it might be engraved on somewhere in Washington on some marble statue. Not sure I'm quoting this exactly right, but it says in substance, the government wins when justice is done, which means that the Solicitor General believed that whether he won the case in the Supreme Court or lost it, if justice prevailed, that was a win. That's not exactly the way it gets translated down the lines.
You told me before we started a quote that is attributable to Abraham Lincoln. Maybe that would be a good way of wrapping up. Share that thought with us again, if you would, please.
Abraham Lincoln is alleged to have said in some address to some lawyer group in 1850, "Resolved to be honest in all events. And if in your judgment you cannot be an honest lawyer, resolve to be honest without being a lawyer. Choose some other occupation."
Thank you for listening to All Things Judicial, a podcast of the North Carolina Judicial Branch. You can find out more about the Judicial Branch by visiting nccourts.gov.